everything I literally have done in my life, I want to tell you, I owe, ladies and gentlemen, to Naval Aviation.
Jim, as you were flying in the fleet, you were out in the Pacific as well, yes?
And yes, I'm getting my wings in 54. I, as a nugget, that's what they call you in those days, they gave me a piece of paper, and the piece of paper said, what coast would you like to be assigned to, East Coast or West Coast? And so I didn't know too much. I came from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which was right in the middle, of course. So I said, East Coast. Then they said, what squadron would you like to, or what airfield would you like to go to? And I said, well, Quonset Point. And so they gave me the West Coast and Moffett Field, California. But I have to tell you, it was the greatest thing in the world, because the skipper of a squadron called VC-3, his job, and he had a squadron of 122 officers and 800 enlisted, his job was to send night fighter teams out to the carriers, because in the early 50s, the squadrons didn't normally fly at night on carriers. We were still learning how to do that. And when I got to the squadron and I found out that I was going to be a night fighter pilot, I said, hey, you know, I'm still learning to fly in the daytime here. What's going on? I got aboard Team Jig. We went out on the Shangri-La. Pardon? Yeah, well, two of us on the Shangri-La.
Made a cruise on a Shangri-La.
And there was the first angled deck in the Pacific at that time. The rest were all straight deck carriers. And my care qual period was in October of 55. My first night launch was in February of 56. And talk about being rusty, but that story was really wild.
you became a test pilot pretty soon, into PACS, and spent 4 years program director on the F-4 Phantom. Tell us about the Phantom and about what you did with that.
Well, I applied for the test pilot school, got there. Before I got there, I got a chance to fly a lot of different Navy airplanes, the Crusader, the Demon, the FJ-4, the Skyray, and things like that. But I was assigned to fly in the weapons test, and my job was basically to test the airplane, the Phantom, the F-4, as a weapon system. Up until that time, airplanes came as airplanes, then they put bombs and rockets and, you know, guns on them. But pretty soon they decided to integrate the whole thing into a weapon system. So my job was to test the airplane as an integral system in the electronics and the weapons and the combination between the two. I was the 32nd person to fly the F-4 after the company pilots had done the initial work. I did the Navy preliminary evaluation and also the Bureau of Inspection and Survey trials on the airplane.
So you're a test pilot. Gene, you were not a test pilot, but you skipped over your two A4 A4 cruises. What were you doing? What was your mission in the A4? What did you train to do?
Well, when I got into the fleet after training, I went to what they called a replacement air group for a few months and care qualed, and then made two cruises. Golly, we were out for 11 months, came home for five. This is the Western Pacific. Went out for nine or 10 more, came home, and I was about ready to get out of the Navy. I'd done what I'd wanted to do. I wasn't sure what I was gonna do. And you know, we cruised the Western Pacific from Vladivostok down. Those are the time, David, that's the Cold War, and most of these folks don't understand or know what that was about. That's the time we were ready to launch when the bell rang with a big bomb. I mean, I had targets in China and Russia, and you know, we never knew what was going to happen, but we were ready to go. That's what we were there for.
To flip nukes off your A4.
Pardon?
To flip nuclear weapons off your A4.
Off the A4, and when we came back to where the carrier was supposed to be, no one figured it would be there anyway. But so that could have been a hellacious series of events, and it didn't happen, thank God. But the fact that we were ready to do it is probably what kept it from happening. And so I came back, and I was about ready to get out of the Navy, and they convinced me to go to postgraduate school up in Monterey. I just got married, and not a bad place to go for, you know, for a few years. And once I did that, I pretty much committed to staying in the Navy for a while. And so my next goal after 2 or 3 years in postgraduate school was test pilot school. And I'm one of those guys, and while I was in Monterey, I got this call, because I didn't apply for the space program. During that period of time, Jim's group of nine with Neil Armstrong and Stafford and Lovell and those guys, or Stafford and Borman and those guys had been selected. And lo and behold, they came out with another request for a selection of people. I didn't have enough jet time. I hadn't been at test pilot school. I didn't apply. And I'm one of those guys, that's why I say I'm the luckiest guy in the world. Somehow, I walked in the course of that selection process, I walked into the Old Rice Hotel in Houston, Texas, and I promise you there were 400 of the finest aviators in the world that this country could produce. They flew higher, faster, combat experience, all of them, and me. And I, you know, when I was on the moon, I said, golly, what am I doing here? When I was in that lobby or in that hotel ballroom, I said, what the hell am I doing here?
And Jim, and he was the only selectee, right, who was not a test pilot.
I think Gene's very humble here. So he's a great aviator.
Well, let me go back one step further. When I came back from my second cruise in the spring of 61, Alan Shepard flew on May 5th of 1961. I was still in San Diego, ready to go up to Monterey, California, to postgraduate school. And we watched Alan go, first American in space, who, by the way, was a naval aviator. I can go on with that commercial a long time. And someone asked me at that point in time, how would you like to do that? And I sat behind a defense of that television screen. Oh man, I'm a red hot jet pilot, naval aviator, invincible, and you know, invisible, bulletproof. I could do anything. I'm sitting there behind it. Boy, I'd love to do it. Just give me a chance. Knowing all the time that I wasn't qualified, I hadn't been there long enough. And I remember the answer to this day. I said, by the time I get ready and good enough, all the pioneering will be over. There won't be anything left to do. That's a message for young people. You just never know, because 10 years later, I stood right next to that same Alan Shepard, the night that he went to the moon, the night before he went to the moon on Apollo 14. And I stood there as backup commander of his flight, back up to him. So I had to be his equal. But I had already flown twice, gone to the moon, and walked in space, and he still only had 16 minutes of space flight experience. Young folks out there, never count yourself out. Go out and do your best, and as my dad said, someday it's not going to be better than everyone else's best, but someday you're going to surprise yourself. And, you know, and that was a surprise.
I Gene has a very good point, because one thing you should do if you fail the first time, try and try again, especially for the young people in the audience. I applied actually for the Mercury program, the Shepherds, the Glens, and I was one of the last 32 candidates to be selected for that program, and I didn't make it. And so highly disappointed, because I was the only guy that could spell rocket, I think, in that particular time. And but the Navy came back and said, would you like to try again? And I said, yes. And so the lesson I learned was, you just don't give up. If you fail the first time, you just charge again.
All right, Jim, so that first, there were 6 Mercury flights, and then the bridge program, the stepping stone program to Apollo was Gemini, two guys, and each of those 10 flights. Gemini 7, Jim, you flew that. What was it? What was your mission? How did it go? Why was it important what you had to do in Gemini 7?
Well, the Gemini program was to try to solve all those problems we might have going to the moon on Apollo. One of the things that we had to do was to see if people could live in zero gravity for 2 weeks. That was the maximum length of time to go to Apollo and come back that they had thought at that time. So Gemini 7 was designated to, first of all, spend 2 weeks in space under zero gravity. A lot of the doctors at that time said, now, 2 weeks zero gravity, when you think that the body was evolved under the Earth's gravity, you know, it just won't work. But it turned out that all the systems in the body work just as well in zero gravity as they do under Earth's gravity. The second thing we had to do, because of some problems we had with Gemini 6 and its Agena, was to rendezvous for the first time. And so Gemini 6 waited until after Gemini 7 was in space for about 12 days and then finally launched, and Gemini 6 rendezvoused with Gemini 7 to prove that the first rendezvous and the techniques they were using for rendezvous were true to form, and they turned out to be that way. So Gemini 7, long term, and rendezvous.
And also known as the only zero gravity porta potty.
Now, Jim, would you like to address that question that your colleague has raised here? Because I do at times good taste and not ask certain questions.
The most often asked question, of course, about that Gemini 7 flight, 2 weeks with Frank Borman, of course, and was how did you go to the bathroom? And of course, our stock answer was very, very carefully. But we had, of course, we had a system of going to the bathroom using a sort of a bag of some sort. Anyway, 9 days had gone by of this 2 week mission. And before the flight, we ate special food that would slow down the process of having to get rid of something. And after 9 days, Borman looked at me and said, Jim, this is it. I said, Frank, you only have 5 more days left to go here.